it. All right, there's Chris Martin in there. The A team's in place, or the B-plus team. Oh, hey, Tom, how are you? There you are.
Well, now this feels like a fall day in the Pacific Northwest.
Doesn't it, though? summer. I forget that Ogden Nash summer sneeze are to have and to hold, but never mind. It'll come to me. All right, let's see. The mayor of Seattle, her last budget, bringing it forward. She has a press conference. I assume we're not taking it live, right?
No, it's on at 5, and I'm sure our great crack news staff will be able to be on top of it during our news breaks.
Yes, she will speak about police. Well, she gave us a little idea what's coming on Friday. She talked about...
We'll do the things that we've heard from community, like expanding the Duwamish Valley Youth Corps, fund the development of a rehabilitation of really important community spaces.
Huh? That's it? That's kind of the stuff she's going to be talking about? I guess that's part of it. Then she's going to talk about policing and then affordable housing and stuff like that. She then presents the budget, gives it to the city council, and then have a chance to sort of pick up, change what they want on the thing. Can they just sort of strike out? Is it, you always hear about the president's budget is already dead on arrival. Is it the same sort of thing when the mayor presents the stuff and then they go, we see what you want to do. We'll raise you 10. We'll get rid of this and get rid of that. And then I guess at that point, the city council then votes in the budget they would actually like to have.
That's right. So this is, now, I mean, this is a long process. It's
okay.
So she proposes her budget, and then for the next 2 months, you've got the city council reviewing it and modifying it and coming up with their own version. So I don't know why you played that particular cut. Are there any other clips from her?
It's all I have. That's
from
what Chris
the
Martin,
okay, that's
the
fine.
Sort of sit-in producer, who, by the
that's
way, found
fine.
Out he was producing
not
the show about 3 hours
can
before.
Can I point out that the event has not happened yet?
Yes, I know. I thought he was going to foreshadow some of it.
Well, he dipped into the future just for us, John.
He dug deep. He dug deep. Thank you, Chris.
So I think some of the headline-y kind of stuff, the thing that's going to get the most, what do they say, review and modification, I think, from the city council, is her proposal that her budget would allow for a net gain of 35 officers. Now, what's kind of, this isn't just like 35 more officers. This is a net gain. So let's say that, you know, we lose 70 more or 130 more. She's not calling for just replacing those that have left. She's actually calling for a net of 35, and then a huge chunk of the money that she's now proposing. Unlike in 2021, where we had financial assistance for COVID from the feds, we basically did that on immediate coverage, like homeless shelters and food relief. Now, because things are starting to get back in place, our economy's picking up, she's going to allocate $50 million this time out from those funds for the construction of an affordable housing. So rather than kind of like slapdash, hurry, let's get these people shelters, we're actually starting to plan ahead. I think those are the things that are going to get the biggest review from them. So.
Okay. We'll wait till 5. Thank you, Chris, for that. As you mentioned, she's going to talk about police. She's going to try to add more police. So the news comes out. The FBI releases the homicide rate has increased in 2020 by some 30-some% across the United States. Some cities seeing more, some seeing about average. But it's nice to know that Seattle's in there contributing its amount of shootings as well. Des Moines, I guess Des Moines, we had how many people killed? 3?
Evidence of what happened outside La Familia Sports Pub was still here as a violent Saturday night gave way to the gloom of this Sunday morning. Natalie Silva was asleep next door in the Red Lion Inn when the shooting started.
Everybody started screaming and people started just going crazy. Like, it was like a war zone out here.
They tell us there were about 200 people in this parking lot when the shooting started. It's a wonder more people weren't hurt. As it is, 2 men and a woman were killed here, 3 others badly hurt.
Okay, here's the most amazing thing. 200 people out there. No one gave a description to the police. Does anybody have any idea what anyone looked like? Does anybody give me a license plate? Can anyone tell me anything? Crickets. So normally police will be outside of nightclubs when the nightclubs are letting out because they know that's when the problem starts. So they sort of stand. They used to do this in Belltown. You would stand out there. knowing the club is going to let out, get a couple guys that have been there kind of, you know, bumping around on each other, and then they step outside. What they normally do is you can't get into the nightclub with the gun. So you go in, you get into a tussle with somebody, then you come out of the nightclub, then you run to your car and get your car and shoot the other guy, or you get in the car, you drive by and shoot the other guy. That's the way it works. So I guess that's what happened there. They had, you know, shooting at one another, and not one of the 200 people there want to tell the police what anybody looked like, which to me smells like gang stuff, right?
I mean, 200 people are probably not all members of a gang.
No. But if you know that guy's a gang guy, I'm not going to say anything. Are you going to say anything? If you know that guy's in a gang, would you tell anybody what he looked like?
According to the FBI's, so first of all, I think you've actually underplayed the lead.
Oh, we're going to get to the FBI. I'm just letting you know that we're contributing our, this is 2021. These are our homicides, right? Aren't we way up as well in Seattle in 2021?
Well, no, I mean, what's interesting about that, because we tend to be locally focused since we're a local radio station, that you think that things are particularly bad here. And it turns out this is a national problem in big cities and small cities. Yeah. It's up 30%, which, I mean, that sounds like a humongous amount, and it is, but it's the largest one-year increase since we started keeping track of these things in the 1960s. So this is a huge deal. Now, their suggestions about why, there are a whole bunch of solutions, or not solutions, explanations for why these things happened. Uh-huh. And of course, they say conservatives want to blame the anti-police attitude. Liberals want to blame, too many guns or easy accessibility of guns. And they say most of the criminologists say it's obviously a mix of those and many others. So in this in this particular case in Des Moines,
Can I shoot down one?
I don't care. It's not shoot down a bull if you've got theorists, who deal with this, suggesting that they're all of these. What are you going to shoot down? That there's too many guns?
I'll go after the guns, yeah.
Okay, of course you would, but that's good. Feel free.
Okay. Let's take 1990, which was a high point in New York City. 2,500 people killed. Number of guns registered legally and purchased in 1990.
174,000. Okay, you're starting to
2020.
Okay.
What I'm going to point to is it's not about the number of guns, because I'm telling you the number of guns that were purchased and registered in 1990, 174,000. There were 2,500 people killed in New York City. The number of people killed in New York City, like in 2019, prior to the government lockdown, was about 300 or less. Number of guns purchased and registered in 2020 or 2019 was 2.2 million. So what we have is an increase in the number of guns. We had a decrease in the number of homicides. I'll take other states that have high gun per capita, low homicide, low poverty rate.
Well, yeah, well, that's like Canada.
No, it's not. Too. It's like Wisconsin. It's like Vermont. It's like New Hampshire. Those states have high gun per capita, medium to low poverty, and then also have low homicide. So what I'll take out that it's, more guns. No, it's not more guns, because it's so concentrated in whose hand the gun is in. It's not about more guns. More guns were purchased legally. More guns were sold. More people have them than before. Got that. The homicide rate is still happening in a very small, tiny, teeny, tiny point of the population in a very small section, not in the right inside where all the protests were, but just outside of major urban areas. So it's not about the guns. The guns in the hands of people that have no respect for the law and that have basically been forgotten by society. You take those two people that feel as if you disrespect me, well, then I'm going to go shoot you. I mean, absolutely no regard for either their life or anyone else's life. Getting into an argument and shooting and killing somebody over a whatever just says something about sort of the pathology of the people that are shooting one another.
Okay, and one of the end results of all of the social justice protests over the George Floyd killing is that there is even less respect for police right now, that more people are less willing to call the police for help because they don't trust the police. And they also then don't provide information to investigators about the killings, which allows for these killings to prosper. That is another angle, a kind of a thread. They said the whole COVID situation with the lockdown and the kind of stress that people are under, people take the law into their own hands, and that's seen as one of the reasons for these a rise in killings as well, because it does you do have this kind of sense of lawlessness out there.
Right.
And I don't know. I think that it sounds like you're kind of dancing around.
No, I was going to punch a hole in part of that as well. The homicide rate had increased in January in 2020 prior to the government locking down, something it's never done before. It would be one of the biggest mistakes it's ever made in the last 100 years. Prior to the lockdown, the homicide rate increased. So what happened is during the lockdown, when the government shut everybody in, cut down on rape, you cut down on available, you know, people that
crime went down.
Right, because there were less, because it's supply and demand, because you had less people on the street that you could possibly rob or rape. So you took care of that part. Less stores were open, couldn't do as much stealing, but you still had people shooting and killing one another. So it's not about poverty, because on average, most American families that were middle class or in the lower quintile, their incomes actually went up 10% during the lockdown, because the government actually gave more money to people and to more households than they had prior experienced. So it wasn't about a lack of money. It was a breakdown.
No one suggested lack of money.
They talked about poverty, that like people were desperate. They weren't desperate for money. The social systems that normally might have kept people working and people in school. Did you know 20% of black men 18 to 24 are neither in school or working? Isn't that a crazy statistic?
Yeah, it's terrible.
It's 10% for white men. 18 to 24.
Okay. So are you dancing around this? You're blaming blacks for this rise in violence? Is that what you're trying to avoid saying by suggesting that it's only
am I blaming a black person for shooting another black person? Who gets the blame? Yeah. Is it the guy that gets shot and killed, or is it the guy that pulls the trigger? Should we feel sorry for the person who gets killed, or feel sorry for the person who pulls the trigger? I feel sorry for both, because both individuals' lives are completely ruined.
That's good.
But Tom, it is not about the police and systemic racism. It is not about too many guns. It is a problem where you have a society that is a kid grows up without anybody being able to tell that kid right from wrong. And then that kid ends up being subjected to a world where there is no job. There is crappy education. I blame that on the government. And what are you going to do? You have no father. You're 10 years old. The kids that you admired are 14. They're 4 years older, and they're running in a gang, and at least they have some money. And the whole culture that you're surrounded by ends up, what are your other choices? You have nothing to risk. You pull the trigger because you have nothing to lose. I don't kill people with my guns because I've got a lot to lose. I have a lot to look forward to. If you're 10 years old, you have very little to look forward to. So then the risk reward of shooting somebody is like, it's almost inconceivable to most people. Like, why would you shoot somebody over a pair of shoes, or shoot somebody because they bumped into you?
Well, that's
what I'm talking about, is a pathology inside this group of people that have ended up, you know, causing this, right?
I mean, you can agree with liberals then that there are social constructs that are contributing to this kind of violence.
Oh, yes, absolutely.
It's not an individual thing.
It's not an individual thing. There's something pathological within that culture and society's willingness
to
deal with
it. Culture. It's not that's our culture. That's an American culture. You can't just sort of say, oh, that's on them. It's not me. It's all of us contributing to that culture.
Because if you are failing the kid in school, and the schools stink, and you don't give choices to that parent who's desperate to move his child or her child out of a bad school and send it to a better school.
Or make the bad school a good school,
Well, we've been doing that for 40 years. We now spend $23,000 per student, Tom, and the grades don't get any better. No, give them a choice. Why don't you let them have a choice?
But, okay, so the thing is that what's interesting about the FBI account is that we are used to hearing all these reports about D.C. and New York and Chicago and all these killings. But they say that what's startling about this is that it seems to be in small towns as much as big cities and all the places in between. So this really is a much more universal kind of an issue, a problem. I assume that we all think that killings are a problem. Yes. So it's more universal than just big city, inner city kinds of issues, which normally are the ones that get the headlines. Okay.
Right. Well, that's what the statistic that I was reading, that it wasn't happening inside, like where all the protests were, where everyone's out marching around and then other people going in and stealing shoes. It was outside those urban areas, like east and west, north and south, outside the densely populated areas, and it sort of had spread out into other areas as well. But, you know, overall, we look at this number, it's the biggest increase in 1 year, which is a 30% increase. The highest it was like in the 90s, and then it started coming down. They went back up again, came up, came up, but down again. It sort of floated around a little bit, but and they still can't tell why, but you can still tell who's shooting who. That's the amazing thing, is the chance of you being shot and killed if you are born in a certain neighborhood with all sort of the factors lined up against you. You stand like a one in eight chance of possibly running into some situation where someone's going to shoot at you. It's pathetic. And the reason the homicide rate isn't higher is because in big urban cities, we've gotten so good at saving these people, at saving people that come in and they go into the stretcher. At Chicago, they said the reason where homicide is not as high as it could be is because we're so used to seeing gunshot wounds. We know how to save every one of these people. Not every one, but a good percentage of them. So it's just, I don't know. I mean, hopefully it goes back down again in 2022, but I would assume it's a combination of a bunch of stuff, right?
Well, in fact, the end result, the interesting thing, John, at the end of that article, they say one of the problems is we're switching over. We now are trying to nationalize stats, criminal statistics, so we get a better sense of how the, well, because we're shifting over to a new program, there are something like 18,000 police departments in this country. That they're not on board, and so there's a hunch that for the next 4 or 5 years, we're going to lack the stats we have right now that are good because we're trying to make them better. There's going to be falling through the cracks. So it'll be tough to keep track if we're getting better or worse.
I'll add one more thing that also happened during the lockdown. A lot of the social programs that were like a Boys and Girls Club or something like that, when those things got dismantled and the people had to stay home and the people got laid off, you weren't able to intervene. So maybe you had a 10-year-old kid said to one of the mentors, hey, my brother's mad about this or that. There might have been some, you know, it only takes a couple of people to say something to stop it, right? So when the government closed those things down, they were also part of the excess death that needs to be contributed to the overall COVID numbers.
And one of the problems, they say, COVID changed a lot of social dynamics. The problem is the bad habits that we picked up during the COVID times, even when we're post-COVID, now are going to be hard to kind of pull back.
Yeah.
It's a mess.
We're never going to be post-COVID, Tom. We'll be post-lockdown. I saw the big sign over I-90, let's stop COVID. You're not going to stop COVID.
Well, you know, there was a headline, though, in the paper. Did you see that? Something about being able to take a pill? That there is this chance that we might be able to stop it more or less dead in its tracks. Not completely eliminated, but, you know, for all intents and purposes. So, you know, it may be a pipe dream, but it's out there.
Okay, let's get those pills. I'll be the sponsor for the pills. we'll talk Seahawks when we come back. And by the way, I'm going to tap out and let my son come on and talk to you, Tom.
I love
Tracy Taylor looked at traffic. Here we go, Kiel Mortgage, 1-888-778-KIEL. Thank you, Laura Kiel, everybody there at Kiel Mortgage, for all the hard work you do. I had dinner with my friends, Larry, Dana, and
that's just
Myers
one.
As well.
Okay.
Yeah, Larry and Dana, and the Myers, Todd Myers, and his beautiful wife have moved to Cleveland, Tom. And,
no.
Todd
Myers has?
Yes.
That's hilarious.
And it's so funny. We're sitting having dinner, and I'm having dinner with Rye as well. We're there, and Larry goes, don't say anything about the Seahawks game. I've got it taped. I can't wait to watch it. And it's so weird when you know the person doesn't know what you know, and you know what they're in for, and you feel like so sorry for them because you're like, I really want to be like, can I just put you out of your pain right now and just say, you know what? Just watch the first half.
Russell drops back in the shotgun. Two receivers near side. Tyler Lockett is the slot on the left.
There's your highlight right there.
Metcalf is wide to the right. Russell looks far side. Throws it out to Metcalf. He makes the catch. Does he get it? And he does! Touchdown, Seahawks! Just a quick out route to the right side, DK Metcalf, who then stretches that long 6'4" body toward the pylon. He gets the ball across, and it's a touchdown from 10 yards out. The Seahawks on top in their opening drive.
And that point, Larry could have turned the television off and would have walked away happy. Like, well, they are the Seahawks I know and love. And they Vikings seemed completely flat-footed. And then at that point, it was, what the hell? In the second half. And that's when I stopped watching. So I asked my son to call in. And all I've done is recorded him, Tom. So you can talk. And then occasionally Tom or I will jump in. But go ahead.
Okay. Well, so perfect. Just like the game before. We were ahead at halftime, 17. At one point, we were ahead 17-7 in the first half. Yeah. And I, when they crept back into the game, you know, I thought, oh, that's okay. I mean, I still felt confident the Seahawks were going to win. We're the better team. Even though we're on the road, I think we were favored. This is fine. That team was hadn't won a game yet. And then as the third quarter ended and I realized that we weren't doing anything, Seattle, and Minnesota, we couldn't stop Minnesota, I realized, oh, no, no. Now I don't think we are going to win this game. And we ended up getting thumped. We got no points in the second half. Yeah. We had the ball like three times, I think, in the, I mean, it's just like we couldn't do anything defensively to stop them. So it was absolutely disastrous. Now, here's what's happened. Here's my only justification for why we shouldn't
disastrous. Yes, go ahead, Tom.
Here's why we shouldn't necessarily jump ship yet.
Okay.
The last two teams that we played that we were beating handily at halftime, Tennessee and Minnesota, what they did say was what those teams had on their side was desperation. Tennessee, you know, got thumped their first game, and they were behind at home against Seattle. So they were desperate enough to win. Same thing, Minnesota was 0-2. They were desperate to win. I think finally Seattle's put itself in a position to being desperate enough that they have to win.
Maybe
we will.
Chip on the shoulder, right?
Dad, I can take this one. And Tom, I got to say, you're right as always. I think this is a team that is very shallow and has a lot of good, strong names. You look at Jamal Adams, Bobby Wagner, you know, even Carlos Dunlap. You can kind of get a sense, maybe an illusion, that this is a good football team. Sort of the same deal with the offense, but that's been the same thing for about the better part of a decade with, you know, Russell Wilson, Tyler Lockett, DK Metcalf. It's like, how is that not going to be a good offense, including Chris Carson? But then you look sort of below that. It's a team that doesn't really have any good role players. You know, the second level guys, the third level guys that come in there, so you're supposed to do their job. We don't really have that. A really bad secondary. I mean, Quandre Diggs, that's another name. He's a good player. Not exactly an elite coverage player, more of a sort of a bruising strong safety or a free safety, that is.
Wow, look at Ryan.
And certainly can't make up for the mistakes that Trey Flowers is going to make inevitably on the back end. In that deep cover three that they keep trying to run.
Okay. Yeah, that's, way to go, how's Rye. That? You agree with Rye?
Yes.
18-year-old kid.
The weird thing about this is he's right. We have a lot of stars, not only on offense. I mean, more people know that because we like offense more. So, you know, Tyler Lockett and, you know, Chris Carson and DK and obviously Russell. But on the backside, we've got Carlos Dunlap and we've got Quandre Diggs is sort of like the Cam Chancellor. He's kind of like the missile, the hard hitting guy, along with Jamal Adams. I mean, we do have remnants of what could be if we had a few more players, another Legion of Boom. However, we don't have much of a team, and the team doesn't play well. It was amazing. Even, you know how you hear Wyman and Rabel broadcast the game. Well, they are pro Seahawks, obviously, and even they're kind of scratching their heads. And they're going, why are we playing so far off? Why are we like 6 yards deep? You know, why are these guys so wide open? I mean, they were just like, I just don't understand what the scheme is. They can't figure out if it was scheduled that way or not. That we, at this point, we have no identity as a team. But everyone's saying, what's our identity? Are we a passing team or a running team? And we have neither. And the problem is because we're not good at anything. Usually your identity is what you're best at.
Right
now, we have one of the greatest quarterbacks of his generation, and we're getting zip out of him, mm-hmm. you know, in the second half for two games in a row. I'm a little concerned. Here's why Seahawks fans are.
I'll ask you to speak to the next game coming up, and then Rye's going to channel me. So go ahead.
Okay, good. So San Francisco. Here's the problem with San Francisco. Okay. They're a big rival, right? They're really good. They did lose their running back. But here's the problem with San Francisco. They just lost a thriller last night to Green Bay. So they're coming off a loss. We're both coming off a loss. We both will be motivated. We both may feel a little desperate. And because it's a home game for San Francisco, they are going to feel like we need to win this one. And I'm a little concerned about us because we are already two games behind two other teams in the division. If we lose another one, we'll be two games behind San Francisco, and maybe three games behind L.A. We have to play San Francisco and L.A. back-to-back in our division. If we lose those two, and we'll be underdogs in both those games, if we lose both those two, we'll be 1-4, and there's no way if we're in that position.
If I were 18, this is what I would say.
There isn't a bad team in the NFC West. If there is, it's definitely us. possibly right. Could be overreacting. 1-2, you look at around the league, there are a lot of good teams that are 1-2. The Chiefs, for example. But, the 49ers are a really sound team. They're back healthy this year, and I think it's going to be a similar story. Might be able to come out, post a couple of touchdowns or field goals, get some points on the board early. But Jimmy Garoppolo, who has struggled, I think even it won't be an issue. They've got a lot of talent. Of course, George Kittle and Debo Samuel. So I think we lose again. That's all I got.
Yeah. I know. We're going to be underdogs.
We're down three games.
Yeah. Oh, no. Yeah, we'd be 1-3.
We've lost three games.
We'd have to play L.A. in the first four games.
Oh, my God. And
L.A.
is on fire.
The best. They destroyed Tampa Bay yesterday with Tom Brady. Yeah, things are – the great thing about football is just when you least expect it, there are upsets. And I think we could – I'm half predicting that we're going to upset – San Francisco, not because we're a better team, but because we're the more desperate team.
So you, your whole premise of the motivation is humiliation that
exactly.
You just play. So you go. You're just so desperate for a win. You're more desperate than the other team.
Yeah, you'll play.
Then how come
a little
the Cleveland
harder?
Browns went like 0-18 so many games? Where was the desperation for a team?
Well,
like
the difference,
that?
John, is they didn't have any talent at the time, and they had lousy coaching. Okay. I believe in our talent. I believe in our coaching. We're going to win a few games. We may not All even right. we were supposed to be a Super Bowl contender. We might not even make the playoffs. This is concerning. It's all going to be changed come Sunday, though. We're going to win and set the world on fire.
All right. All we need is that guy to kick a 66-yard field goal.
Sure, I'll take it.
Did you see it? Did you see it bounce in?
I didn't see it, no.
You didn't see the highlight, Tom?
No, which game are you talking about?
Tracy Taylor, you saw it.
Which game are you talking about? Are you talking about the
Seahawks
game?
It was a record-setting field goal, 66-yard field goal. Wasn't that 66 or 68-yard field goal? And it hit the upright and bounced in.
Yeah, and he didn't make it in the pregame, too. Remember, he tried it before the pregame, and he didn't make it, so he didn't think that he was going to make it, and he made it.
Yeah.
Right?
Thank you.
There's I still don't know analysis. What team we're talking
about. Gee whiz, that was like the highlight. I can't remember either one of them. anyway, everyone's going to text in right now. Tracy Taylor, take care of traffic for us. All right, I know. Tucker kicks it. Ravens, 66 yards, beats the Detroit Lions in the final seconds. Everybody's texting. Justin Tucker, Ravens, Lions, come on, guys. Sorry, we're so busy not watching the Seahawks game. All right, Dave Kroll from the Foo Fighters. This is a great story. But we get the whole setup on the story on this one, Chris, the entire thing.
Yeah, it's pretty much
Dave
in here.
Okay, it's all in there. So Dave Kroll said the idea is that this is the idea of doing something nice for somebody, and then it comes back to you in the form of a chair. Here is King Five's Callie Green.
In a sold-out show, it's the first time Darren Wall's taken the stage since he was shot.
Well, and it's only been about 3 weeks. So 3 weeks off, and we're back into it.
He admits he's nervous and excited, still recovering after stopping a gunman at a venue in Idaho. That's when Darren was shot in the leg. We spoke to him just days after it happened.
And it's my belief that if he'd entered the bar, that he would have used that gun on a lot of people that night.
The gunman was arrested by Boise police, and Darren's band Greyhawk is ready to rock again.
It just feels like a celebration that we're still here, still alive.
A celebration that will go down in rock and roll history.
It's a wild Mad Max production.
Sitting on this stage is the throne, used by a few rock stars who've needed a little help.
Right, there's three people that have used this. It's Dave Grohl, Axl Rose from Guns N' Roses, and me.
Wow.
It belongs to Dave Grohl, who rocked out while sitting after breaking his leg during a tour in 2015.
Actually, Dave's leg was a right leg, so they had it customized for my left leg, too.
The power of social media brought the throne to Darren.
And it got into the Foo Fighters management, who asked me what was going on. I sent them your news story. They looked at that. They showed it to Dave Grohl. He called me from the MTV VMA Awards and basically said, I'll ship that throne up to you at my expense.
Darren says this is a symbol of the rock and roll community coming together.
Wow, can you imagine that?
Yeah.
Get a phone call, you look down, hey, it's Dave Grohl from Foo Fighters. Like, what? That's good. I mean, the throne, Tom, when you hurt your knee, you had that big operation on your knee. Didn't we get you a throne? What did we get for you? I can't remember.
I wish. I think I put a rickety old wooden chair under my leg and called it good.
But we did auction off your leg brace at the auction to raise money for a local charity. So it did come around. And we reenacted you falling and breaking, messing up your leg. Remember that?
That's right. And I never got to see that because I was behind stage. So I was hoping somebody would take a picture of it or a video of it, like my brother or my wife or something. And I never did see that. But yeah, I loved it. You were impersonating me, and Rachel Bell was playing my mom.
Your mom,
and I missed it.
I think Felix was in it, too. Yeah, we were at a graveyard, and we were visiting, I think, your father's grave or something.
Yes.
It was. You started to fall.
Yeah.
And as you were falling back, you then reached out to save your mom
because
you didn't want to knock her down. And then, I did the whole thing in slow motion. Of course, there's no video of it. All of the things we do live, no one ever bothers to record it or videotape it. It's like,
It was our third show, and they said, well, we never video, or the wheel to videotape. Don't you worry. Well, they did like the, 30 seconds of it or something.
Yeah.
And so I never did see it. If anybody was at the show and took a picture of it, I'd love to see it.
I mean, I think there's video of John Wilkes Booth at the Kennedy Theater. But anything or a Ford Theater, nothing of us.
All right.
Tracy Taylor looking at the traffic.
Where is Jacob in all of this? And why isn't he doing that, getting video of you guys?
He's not even here now.